Hi, this is Jean Bruce Scott.
And Randy Reinholz.
And when we're not busily producing some of the most outstanding Native American theater in Los Angeles,
we always like to check out the best of British audio adventures with Alex Lefchuk and his team of the Midweek Drive.
And Midweek Drive morning editions on Siren FM.
And southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com.
Do you know, there are certain co-presenters who you just feel are magical, and they open up a level of light and enjoyment and positivity that, frankly, the world is a better place for them. And we have not one, but two of those fine folk today. First of all, Pamela Sue Mann, musician extraordinaire, of course, from New York, our official New York correspondent. How are you, Pamela? She's nodding. That's the important thing. And today, you know, even more awesomely wonderful, from Los Angeles, she actually coined the phrase, living in God's holy truth, the light scenario. It's Lee Taylor Young. She's back with us. How are you, Lee?
I'm so happy to be with you and see you and be connected across our globe.
Well, exactly. Los Angeles, New York, and Lincoln. It just opens up a whole range of wondrous activities. Now, Lee,
Yes.
I've been managing to sort of catch some more of your fantastic oeuvre. And when last we spoke, of course, we spoke about the Jack Palance, Omar Sharif, Lee Taylor Young epic, written by Mr. Trumbo, of course, first movie back after his blacklisting, etc. And of course, it's the epic The Horseman. And I see exactly what you mean. I mean, as it is, your character of Zara, wonderful, superb in so many ways. Although I must admit, I thought that, you know, once again, I think that, you know, Omar Sharif's character got what he deserved. He honestly, there she was, rescuing his limb, bending it up, you know, binding it, etc. No return, referred to as an untouchable. But once again, we need to start this campaign to get that uncut version from Columbia Pictures put together, because the epic site's fantastic.
Indeed. And it's just one of those things you just wish that it could indeed be resurrected. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, it still works well. And even in the 1 hour, 40 minutes, although there are a few areas there in the narrative where suddenly there's a big jump cut and you think, where? What's happened? It's just surreal. Not the most successful editing process. However, Pamela, are you back with us now? Is your microphone fully functioning?
I'm audible and present.
Excellent.
Wonderful.
Have you got any initial questions you'd like to put to Lee Taylor Young whilst I also welcome our other ace director who's coming online now, and of course is the wonderful Phil Learness, also in Los Angeles. So we've got Los Angeles, New York, and all manner of marvelous things there. Pamela, any questions you'd like to put to Lee at this moment?
Well, goodness, you know, where do I start? I mean, you are such a tour de force. And I guess my question to you is, in the industries that have just like chewed people up and spit them out, like how have you managed to keep such grace and beauty and equanimity and balance, you know, throughout your trajectory upon this earth?
Well, my goodness, that's an epic question. I want to also say hello to Phil.
Linus. It's Phil Learness. I'll formally introduce you. Phil Learness, ace director. And although I say ace director, in so many ways, I think he's had a big lacunae in his CV over the last 20 or so years. I don't think, Phil, you've ever featured the awesome talent of Lee Taylor Young in any of your productions as yet, have you?
Not yet, but I mean, we've got to save some things. I'm just getting started.
There you go. Me too. I want to respond to your lovely question. And I really, you know, when you look back, at you do indeed get to a certain point where you have a vista when you look back. I have indeed. It may sound kind of corny, but I think my nature has a lot of buoyancy in it, just sort of naturally. So my inclination is almost always to write myself to see where the blessing of something is, even if it may be serious disappointment. It could even be a sense of betrayal or, you know, things that I wouldn't like. But I don't like staying in those places, especially when really often they have nothing to do with me. I can't control those choices. They're other people's choices, and indeed I may be at the effect of it, but I'd rather find a way to have my equanimity in my heart. I'm kind of a heart-centered person. So if that is really off, I'm very aware of it because it's my familiar place. So if it's off, either I'm upset or judging or negative, called the human condition. I work pretty hard to write that. I really take it sincerely that, okay, I'm not feeling my natural well-being. It's my job. So I think I'm kind of a person who's self-reliant in that way, to bring my attitude into balance, where I would define that as seeing the expansiveness of life, seeing the blessings, not just the problems. So I really do think that's been my key to whatever might be perceived as grace. I think it is grace because it's the grace of finding where we're the most loving, if possible. So that's my best answer I can give you right now.
Lee, just briefly going on from that, I was privileged today to actually see a movie I hadn't actually encountered before. It was A Hidden Treasure. I thought, you know, I want to actually sort of work my way through your wonderful sort of body of work. And it's The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight.
Oh, gosh.
an extraordinary number with, of course, Robert De Niro. And before we invite Phil to actually take over the interviewing mantle for a few moments, can I just ask you to share with us your experience with Robert De Niro, the method actor / shoplifter?
I know what you're referencing.
In New York, of course.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it's really kind of an homage to Bobby. I'm only known as Bobby. And, you know, at the point at which I got that role, he had, I think, just made a couple of very small roles, a baseball movie, I think, and you know, some little wonderful, he kind of grew up culturally and artistically with Scorsese. They're just a wonderful acting artist group from very young age. He'd made some little vignette movies with Scorsese, but this was his first kind of big one. And I really didn't know who he was. And so we had our first rehearsal. It was in the Stanhope Hotel. The director, I'm not sure he really knew what to do with either one of us. So he decided to send us out into New York City and he gave us the intention to be in character. I was playing a girl from Red Hook, Brooklyn, and I was in process of just meeting the woman who was going to be my dialect coach for that extraordinary dialect. I hadn't even begun. And Bobby was playing an Italian from Sicily, but with broken English. Well, he grew up with a lot of that. You know, he grew up on 14th Street with Italians. He spoke Italian. He was already in character. I hadn't even taken my first foray into the portal of the leaping. Now I'm leaping with him, again, not knowing him. And he's totally in character. I'm processing my awe. We're on a bus going down Fifth Avenue. He's in character of, yes, a character who is a kleptomaniac. I am the daughter of a mafia don, and I'm showing him around New York with my, at that moment, very poor Brooklyn accent, being again awestruck by how amazingly he was in character. We go into Macy's. I'm showing him around, like in character, da da da. We go out of Macy's. We take 10 steps. Big hand grabs my neck, grabs him, turns us around. It's a policeman from Macy's. And Bobby, in character, had lifted a couple of shirts that were stuck in his jacket. You know, very successfully. I hadn't seen him do it. And we were taken up to the sixth floor jail of Macy's and booked. And it was a grand adventure. It was a great adventure in every respect. But again, he had he had taken his studio preparation to a great extent. And I mean, we had a lot of fun with that.
I don't think that's what Stanislavski had in mind when he brought the method to the world. And as far as Lee Strasberg is concerned, I doubt really whether at any time in any period he actually said, go and do some shoplifting. I mean, Phil, is that something you suggested for some of your actors in times to come? You should go that far?
I only want them to steal my heart. I don't want them to steal anything else. You know what I love about having Leon is that this is the first time in all these years we've been working together, Alex, with all the august guests. This is the first time there's actually a guest on the show for whom my favorite joke does not work, because I always love telling stories about famous people and then correcting myself by saying, oh, but I have to remember Bobby De Niro always told me never to name drop. And of course I've never met him, but here's someone who knows Bobby. So my favorite joke doesn't work. Lee, I have a question that I've been dying to ask you, but I want to follow up just really quickly, because you said that you weren't aware of who Robert De Niro was. And, you know, for those of us who maybe knew Jerry Orbach because of Law and Order, let's say that that might have been our introduction to him. I'm imagining for someone like you, who was already a Broadway veteran at a very young age, that Jerry Orbach, working with him, if you had not worked with him before, must have been a really big deal, because this guy was a Broadway legend.
Yes, and Carnival. You know, that show that went forever and ever and ever and ever. When I was 13, my parents took me to New York and I saw him, and he was such a crush for me. You know, it was all bigger than life, and it was Jerry Orbach, and he was my heartthrob for many years. Now, all of a sudden, he's my brother in a movie with Joe Van Fleet, Jerry Orbach, De Niro, a whole bunch of amazing New York actors. It was
Do not forget the lion.
And I have lion stories. Oh, do I have lion stories? You know, like the lion leapt out of the shot. They couldn't contain the lion in Red Hook, Brooklyn, leapt into the people in the street that were watching an exterior shot, got loose, went down the street, and guess what he did? Just like the story, he walked into a bar.
It's a New York thing. I'm sure Pamela will tell us as a standard thing in New York.
A real male lion walking into a bar. You can just imagine. It is like the joke, but that's where they found the lion. Anyway, it was filled with adventures, even if the movie didn't work that well.
How much do we love that you had this experience with the lion on, of all things, a movie that was released by MGM? I mean, you would think they would know how to get a lion who would behave. Speaking of sometimes performers that were perhaps mercurial or unpredictable, your first film, if I'm not mistaken, you've got a front row seat to Peter Sellers.
Definitely.
And
I love what? You, Alice B. Toklas.
Well, thank you, but you promised you wouldn't call me Alice anymore. But Lee, what was that experience like? You're not by any means a rookie actress, but this is your first film production. What was that like being there to witness Peter Sellers?
Well, glorious. I grew up with a lot of difficult people in my life. It was just like maybe God preparing me for life. And I really learned how to navigate fairly young. And I think in a sense, innocence was one of my tools, not knowing that it was a powerful tool. Open-heartedness was a powerful tool, not realizing that it was a powerful tool. Peter and I just connected immediately. I was hired in that role because they couldn't find the girl, and they were starting to shoot in 2 weeks. On a Sunday, I went to Warner Brothers to read for it, and it was with Mazursky and Peter. And immediately Peter said, "Are you ready to report to work?" And I said, "Absolutely." And I even have pictures of me reading with Mazursky and Peter taking photographs, because he was a great photographer. I don't know if you knew that, but a great photographer. And we started shooting, and it was just grand in every sense. And indeed, I had a front row seat to, impetuous is a good word, but I think he had many shifts in his personality. Something would trigger him, and he would go from being just an enchanted person, really, to fiercely out of balance. and could yell and whatever. One day the poor script lady wore purple. And in his view, he'd given a dictum, no one is to wear purple. Purple for him was evil. See, for me, everything's perception. Purple for me is royal and spiritual, but for Peter, it was evil. She wore it and he walked off the set and wouldn't go back to work. So I had the head of the studio calling me, knowing how much Peter loved me and that I regarded Peter. Would I go to the studio and see if I could get him out of his dressing room, where he had dressing room for stars in those days were little casitas, you know, beautiful little houses. And it was a Sunday and I went and he let me in and I just talked to him. It's like talking him back from some psychic edge that he felt somehow had attacked him. And I just loved him, soothed him, came back to work the next day, you know, just he was like my friend. And it didn't bother me one bit that he had these episodes. And I think he knew that. I think he knew that the colorful rainbow of his personas did not bother me one bit. I could contain them and still love and regard him.
It's probably the amount of time he spent with Spike Milligan and Michael Benteen with the Goon Show, singing the Yin Tang song. And Spike exactly. Milligan, who again, I met a couple of times, his line basically that he wanted on his tombstone was, see, I told you I was ill. I mean, you know, it's a very strange world.
But, you know, I think, you know, indeed, but Peter was so part of that genre and those were his buddies. And he introduced me to them, you know, to that world of that kind of crazy comedy, which of course went on to be Monty Python, which I adore because I adore the irreverence. If there's no intent to hurt, it's just the outrageousness of life in all its glory.
And arguably his role as Chauncey the Gardener in Being There. Oh. You had the President of the United States who had more brain cells than the last two presidents possibly put together. But there we are.
I just found this weekend in my storage some amazing boxes of scripts of every script I ever did, not knowing I'd kept everyone, but I do tend to keep things that are meaningful. And I found this amazing picture as Chauncey that Peter wrote to me, and he signed it as Chauncey the Gardener, about being God, you know, about having a relationship with God, because he knew that that was something he and I shared. We shared yoga. We shared that spiritual pursuit in a very profound way. He introduced me to some amazing gurus of the time who became teachers, mentors. So we had an amazing, and a month before he passed, we were in Europe at the Cannes Film Festival. He had a magnificent yacht. I was married to a studio executive at the time. He came to him and asked permission to take me out on his yacht for the day, which we did. Took me to a little island that was somewhat deserted, somewhat near Saint-Tropez. It had a broken down church. We went in and I always carried a little cassette, a recorder of inspirational tapes. And we were in this church with a light coming in over the pew with half the roof off, sitting together and praying. And he told me that he was dying. And he said he couldn't have a heart transplant. He wasn't strong enough and so forth. And he let me know, and I played a beautiful inspirational prayer for him. And we wept, held hands, prayed, and were just a very beautiful friends. And he was indeed gone within about a month.
This is one of the reasons, Lee, why I must admit, I thought of you, a recent quote from Saint Teresa of Calcutta, of course, known as Mother Teresa. And I thought, this is very much a Lee Taylor Young quote. When you know how much God is in love with you, and you can only live your life radiating that love. And I thought, actually, that could be just sort of, that could be your motto in many ways, Lee.
I love that. I mean, you know, to me, loving God is loving everything the best we can, even if we're not in agreement with it. We can allow it, we can accept it, and we don't have to approve of it. But, you know, there's no point in begrudging life, because I don't think it makes us well, number one. And I don't think it does much good for anybody around us either. So it is a discipline and a practice. And I think Peter was wanting that very much, but he was trying to keep a bit on, you know, things for him that were mentally difficult.
Pamela, in a few weeks' time, we're going to be analysing in depth for a show called Resonance Rewind, a fabulous movie called Soylent Green, featuring, of course, and starring Lee Taylor Young. You may have one or two questions about that. You may have other questions. But anyway, as a New Yorker, given that I don't think as yet you've actually chased a lion with a broom, it was probably the nastiest thing that your character actually did in that movie. Actually, she was so nice. Everybody else was such a sort of hurried person. Even the mother of the gangster ended up being it just wasn't working. Whereas you were okay until you chased the lion. I thought you might have adopted the lion, but that's by the by. It's just a minor point. Or maybe it's just the other experiences you'd had as Zara back in The Horseman. Anyway, Pamela, back to you.
That's so. Soylent Green has just jumped the queue. I'm sorry for next week. We're going to be watching that this evening. It's. Well, you know, a very silly thing came to mind because further of the joke, what did the lion say when he walked into the bar? Of course, lions can't speak, but it would be, ouch. but that's not where my mind...
A lovely promotion of your latest song, Pamela. You know, ideal. You're always thinking. It's genius stuff there.
It's the subconscious. So much of what you're saying, Lee, is it's giving me chills because... It's interesting. I write songs primarily. That's what I do. I'm always writing, and you know, my friends know. They'll wake up to a few poems in their little text, and constantly observing and pondering and writing. And I think I was incredibly shy when I was little, and so that was the way that I grew up in a pretty boisterous Jewish family in America. A lot of them being from New York, and I was very shy. They used to call me Shiksa, and I would just sit there with my wide eyes watching everything. And the interesting thing is that it is so much the people that you're drawn to, I was thinking of this as you were speaking, are beacons. And there's a light within them that's radiating. It's not, they're not singularly radiating apart from everything. They're actually radiating what you might call divinity. So the divinity is just emanating from them, but they're receiving it as well. They're not cut off. And yet these are the people that you're drawn to, and the reason you're drawn to them is because it's like a mirror. You want that for yourself, and you notice it in others, and it's such a simple thing, and yet it's so profound, because I think when people feel separate or don't believe in the light, then, or that moment or that part of your psyche that makes it difficult because all of a sudden you're perceiving there is no light. When we all know, I mean, we know there is indeed light, and you carry it, and we all carry it. But it's so exciting. You know, I'm so excited by meeting you, and I know this is truly how you live and how you've moved through the world. And I thank you for saying all of that, because it's so exciting. It just, what it does is it just validates those things within yourself. And I just feel like, yeah, because sometimes I almost feel like a bit of a Pollyanna in the world. And yet, you know, we need that so much. We need that light, and we need that brightness. And so.
And it's so much more fun.
It's so much more fun.
Well, yes. Fun and light is something I sort of was keen to stress even when we first met, Phil, over a decade ago. You're back with us now. Any other thoughts you'd like to share? We were just about to talk Soylent Green, by the way.
Oh, well, I mean, because I love people and Soylent Green is people. So what could be? And they're the luckiest people we know. I just wanted to dial back to when Lee was talking about Peter Sellers. And what struck me was just the overwhelming importance of not taking things personally.
Yeah.
The story demonstrated just a very simple truth, which was you never took any behavior personally, and that is exactly what Peter Sellers needed,
yeah.
Because it wasn't personal towards right. anyone. By the way, if you do write a chapter in a book about the making of that film, the script Lady Wore Purple is a great title for that. But I, you know, the other side to that, though, the importance, especially for creative people who, let's face it, whatever field we're in of creative endeavor, we are in part in a job that is about making ourselves vulnerable. And So the importance, again, of not taking things personally cannot be overstated. And at the same time, though, for everybody out there who watches the work and who gives feedback and offers criticism on the work, how about not making that feedback and criticism personal in the first place? That would also be nice, because we do feel vulnerable. Anyway, I just wanted to say how beautiful I thought that was. And Alex, the floor.
I just want to say how much I'm enjoying you all so much. I didn't know it'd be this much fun.
Well, we sort of introduce you slowly, Lee, with a kind of nice introductory thing. And then we sort of bring in the next sort of stage, which is obviously Pamela and Phil, which is that.
I'm enjoying you both, Pamela and Phil. And Pamela, I think you're, if I may say, I know I'm a girl, but I think you're very beautiful.
I'm thinking the same thing. You're completely girl crushing on each other.
There we go. You're all just terrific. What would you like more that I could share that would help or be of interest?
Let's just briefly look at Soylent Green, because it is a thing which not only are we focusing on another program, Lee, but it's something which I feel is very pertinent, not only because, as we said on your first program, that we are approaching the year which Soylent Green was set in, of course, 2022.
Yes.
We see masks being worn there. We see an introduction in the movie, directed by, of course, by Richard Fleischer, that clearly demonstrates the challenges that we're faced with that have led some people to go down an Extinction Rebellion routine. We've got COP26 occurring. I'm delivering an academic piece for the Being Human conference in November, part of the University of Lincoln sort of approach to that about the whole system. And I think back to the movie itself, and once again, probably you're the main character who blossoms there. The character of Shirl is there, although arguably, as you said, I think, you know, the notion of actually being regarded as the furniture, I mean, it's way before Me Too and other sort of issues. But it also raises that sort of question in terms of how we as human beings can survive within the craziness of the world.
You know, you're bringing Cheryl very in my awareness. And, you know, in seeing the movie, you see that when you first meet her, that she's furniture, that she's accepted this role. This is how life is at this time. And what was memorable in that first opening scene is that was Joseph Cotten at that thing. And that was Joseph Cotten's last film. And such an elegant gentleman. And he's the one who owns the apartment. Thus, he owns me. I'm furniture. He's killed. And I'm like numb. And her transformation really comes from what love can do. Allowing herself to feel connection, which she feels with
Charlton Heston's character.
Charlton Heston's character. I was trying to think of his character's name and I don't have it. But then of course that all shifts. So her transformation is subtle, but one of the things I remember wanting to touch to was her opening sensitivity. She has a line when they first go to bed, which is very matter of fact, very matter of fact, you know, so she knows herself in this position, but when he says to her, "Where did you go?" And she says, "To church." And it was like this line that had this weight of, well, what was that she was experiencing? And it's the beginning of her opening, and it doesn't last long, but I found her a very poignant character. And yes, an extreme case of Me Too.
Yeah, and also you had the in terms of connectivity. Of course, as we mentioned at the start, you were also bandaging Omar Sharif's leg in The Horseman. And of course, you're bandaging Charlton Heston's leg and doing the best you can, because he's also been grazed with a bullet in Soylent Green. It's like a sort of synchronicity that's coming across there. But the movie still resonates. It still opens itself up. And I did feel in a sense that Heston's character, he really should have actually, we should have had that happy ending. Of course, we also had Edward G. Robinson in what was his last role. I mean, you've got Edward G. Robinson and Joseph Cotten and Charlton Heston. So, and Brock Peters, of course, a great lineup.
And, you know, when we did the movie, it was a book, science fiction. And you know, I'm sure you were referencing the first 5 minutes of the movie is like a documentary of what the world as live, real time, what the world is going to environmentally in terms of climate. Daunting 5 minutes that are just so pertinent today. It's eerie to look at the beginning of that movie and see that and then see where we are today, you know, and here we are in that year. And we're really looking at it.
Yeah. And interesting enough, of course, based on the novel by Harry Harrison, Make Room, Make Room. I think it also opened up the notion, I know we spoke about your role in Star Trek Deep Space Nine last time, so we won't talk about Trill and other sort of aspects, but let's move back to one of your own favourite movies from the science fiction oeuvre, of course, the Robert Wise directed Day the Earth Stood Still. Is that, again, something which you think is still pertinent, even back in 1950 when it was originally set? You must have been an infant when you saw it, from that point of view. I saw it in reruns.
It's close. I love that movie. And as strangely awkward as it is, in the sense of certainly it was a sci-fi in 1950, I really loved it. I love it to this day. I think it's very worth being a classic to review, because I think there's so much truth in it, so much truth that we did not listen to. When Michael Rennie's character is saying, do not go this way. If you go this way, this is what's going to happen to this planet. We're here to give you an opportunity to understand. And of course, nobody's listening. Or if they're listening, they're going, no, we're going to go the way of the military-industrial complex. Thank you. It's much more where we want to be going. And even Eisenhower, you know, warned about that, you know, that when he was leaving office, we have to be mindful that we don't lose our democracy to these things. And so the movie is depth, has so much depth. I still love it.
It's also quite interesting that the name that Klaatu chooses when he actually incarnates as a human being is Mr. Carpenter. Of course, a reference to the biblical notion of what was Jesus's occupation before he decided to work through that? Well, it was carpentry.
Oh, interesting.
So was Harrison Ford. And I wouldn't say that he's sort of a
spoiler. Spoiler alert. I hadn't gotten to that part of the book yet about Jesus.
Bill, any closing thoughts or questions you'd like to put in at this stage?
Well, they're closing thoughts. Man, we didn't even get to talk about Neil LaBute and how our friend Lee is working with Neil LaBute on a pilot for the American Gigolo TV series. Is that correct?
Who's Neil LaBute?
A writer, a great writer. He may have written the pilot script.
I don't think so. I may be wrong, but I think David Hollander wrote it, who's also the director.
Okay.
I may be wrong because, oh my goodness, I leave lots of leeway for me being wrong in life. But my sense is, but maybe you're right. I just don't. I know David Hollander is writing forward.
If you had worked with Neil, I expected that you would like it because he's one of our great playwrights and a wonderful independent filmmaker. But I just have to let you know why I kept getting called away, because I feel like
this I wasn't going to mention it, Phil. It is radio, but what the hey?
But I feel like this is well, you did actually say that Phil is back with us. So what is? I mean, that lent itself to a belief that I had gone somewhere. But I had someone coming in to do some repair work on a piece of furniture, and he gave me his business card. And his business card, the name of his company is Treasures of the Past Restored. How's that for the name of a program?
Oh, that's wonderful.
I feel like the four of us could host a program called Treasures of the Past Restored, and it would change the way people look at everything.
It's a way forward. Chill Pack Hollywood, New York Real Stories, and Treasure of the Past, Residence Rewind. Wonderful stuff there. Pamela, anything you'd like to add to either Lee or Phil at this moment?
Oh, goodness. okay. may I ask a question?
Yes.
So what is pressing on your mind at the moment, given everything that's going on, coming through your filter, and being that you are all such philosophically, no pun intended, philosophically open, and I could say positive, which is really because you're searchers. What is the nugget? What is the thing at the moment that you'd like to share?
Or is there a negative? Lee, is it a case of, no, we take all our negatives and turn them into positives?
No, I don't think she said negative. I think she said nugget is what I think she said. What's the nugget?
Yeah. Nugget.
Nugget.
You see, this is what happens when you have a New Yorker, a Californian, and two Californians connected with the whole thing.
What concerns me immediately is your British need to take our nuggets and make them negative. That's that concerns me.
It's the blame our prime minister. That's all I'll say.
I really don't. I'm just right now. My nugget is I'm present. I'm delighted to be present with you all, and that's what I'm aware of. I'm not aware of some big content in the moment, other than I'm just delighted to be here. Thank you, and I'm really thankful that you asked me.
Phil.
I am aware of the importance that sorrow plays in joy. In some measures, the last few years, obviously collectively, might be considered some of our most sorrowful. For me personally, as you know, Alex, losing both my parents and taking care of my sister. And yet at the same time, in some ways, they've been the most fun, joyous years of my life. And the key to it has been, and this is not easy, I don't think this is easy for anyone, it's certainly not easy for me, but to be open to the sorrow of it, to not try to distract myself from the sorrow of it, as I face perhaps what I think will be my final year after 35 years of living in Los Angeles, my final year of living here full time, as I make moves to move to the East Coast. I feel, 35 years with good behavior is enough. But I want to avoid the pitfall that I find so many friends of mine who have blazed this trail before and yet have fallen into, which is this need almost when we're letting something go to build up grievances towards the thing we're leaving behind. Mm-hmm. We don't need to have grievance or regret or any of this in order to say goodbye to something. Indeed, the healthiest relationships are the ones that are easiest to let go of in very important ways. And so I want to love this city as much as I did when I first came here in order that I can say goodbye to it. And that involves embracing the sorrow of all that I'm leaving behind.
An awesome Bravo. Moment. Phil, it falls to you, good self, as a senior co-presenter in this particular stage, to pop those last two questions to Pamela and Lee. So off you go, Phil, to whomever you wish to first. Take it away.
Pamela Sue, man, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoom link with us today?
Biblically.
Well, then can we look forward to seeing you again in the not too distant future?
Yes, please.
Oh, I would love that.
Well, Lee Taylor Young, you've already spoken glowingly about this experience, but has it been relatively interesting for you?
Who are you talking to now?
To you, Lee.
Yes. I'm thrilled to meet you all. It's energy to me too. I mean, I see your faces, and Pamela, I'd love to hear your music sometime. And if there's a way that Alex, you can let me know how to do that. Well,
Lee,
love that.
It will be on this very interview. By the way, did you manage to download the first one successfully?
Not yet, honey, but I have it in my vault. I haven't done it yet. I put these things where they're very important, but I haven't gotten to it yet.
Excellent. Well, it will be.
I can't wait for the opportunity that I get to try to slip in not yet, honey, with you, Alex, and see if it is as charming coming from me as it was from Lee Taylor Young just now. So Lee, physicists tell us that it's possible that the past and the present and the future are all unfolding simultaneously. Does that future that's unfolding simultaneously involve you rejoining us on this show again sometime?
Oh, just ask me.
Lee Taylor Young, Pablo Suman, and Phil Leonis, take care, be well, be happy, and be safe. Namaste.
Everyone, yes.
Bye-bye.
space with splate, you're swimming like a salmon. You take a bite, you better have your head examined. Say I'm too old to play the way you say I ought to. Well, I'm not giving a damn. You threw the you in new into the blue depression. Inside the toilet, you assumed a new expression. Curate the cataract and singular obsession. But can you stop what you start? It's gonna pull us apart.
Of Benjamin in the Mike Nichols movie The Graduate, who was advised to think about plastics. Well, that was back in the 1960s, and we're still thinking about plastic, though possibly not as favourably as we used to. And certainly with National Recycle Week to the fore, it's vital to actually think about how we can prevent ocean plastic pollution. And to talk about this, we're delighted to welcome a genuine legend, Olympic gold medalist, sailor extraordinaire, the wonderful Hannah Mills, MBE. How are you, Hannah?
Hi, Alex. Good, thank you.
Excellent. And of course, we've also got the pioneering Prevented Ocean Plastic Programme, Rafi Shire, with us as well. How are you, Rafi?
Hi, very nice to be with you.
Excellent. Can we come to you first, Hannah, because you've experienced firsthand the challenges of plastic in the ocean and the difficulty within that. So just share with us your own particular experiences for a few moments.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, over the last 10 years, maybe 15, the plastic pollution crisis has become more and more apparent to me. Being out on the waters, we used to rarely see plastics, and now we're seeing them almost every time we go out sailing in some form. And it's pretty stark, to be honest, and pretty scary. And it's everywhere we go. It's not just certain places. It's all over the globe. So, yeah, the plastic pollution crisis is definitely very real for me.
And of course, you are Prevented Ocean Plastics' first ambassador. So that's important from that point of view. I mean, turning to yourself, Rafi, what are the good aspects of this programme that basically, I mean, looking at the figures here, they seem very impressive. They stop 20,000 tonnes of plastic going into the sea, which is the equivalent to 200 blue whales. So talk to us about your own sort of innovation in terms of this.
Well, thank you. For us, the big obsession is to tell the truth in recycling. There's been a lot of misinformation. So what we sought out to do is create a fully traceable, certified program that really works at scale. And then when we do that, we offer a better plastic choice to the consumers in the supermarket. And then when the consumers in the supermarket go, I want to choose recycled, I want to choose prevented ocean plastic, it then changes company behavior. And that change is what's allowed us to get to 20,000 tons of fully traceable plastic away from coastlines and helped us with Little Supermarkets win Sustainable Initiative of the Year here in the UK at the Retail Industry Awards. Our fascination is to tell people the truth about where this plastic comes from and where it could potentially go to.
I mean, Hannah, looking at the notion of recycling, I mean, the vast majority of UK households actually do recycle, 89%. But again, two-thirds of that waste is then sent overseas to be dealt with. Is that, again, a classic case of, well, as long as we brush it under the carpet, it's not our problem anymore?
Yeah, exactly. I think we, you know, every single country needs to be held responsible for the waste they're using and producing. And I don't think shipping it away is any longer a viable option, really. You know, we need to take responsibility and we need to clean up our own act, I guess. And so, you know, programs like the Prevented Ocean Plastic program that Rafi, that I've become an ambassador for, I think is super important because it gives consumers like me and you and everyone else the choice to choose better. And it's a simple, easy choice. And that's really crucial because the power we have as consumers to influence big brands and governments is massive. And so, you know, if we're choosing recycled plastic, then more companies are going to switch to using recycled plastic. And that's a much better option for the environment.
And Rafi, again, was that part of your vision when you sort of established the company, actually looking through that? As Hannah's actually said there, this is a relatively straightforward choice that people can actually make to actually ensure that they are doing their bit for sustainability and the planet.
Well, absolutely. And for us, it's an enormous honor and pleasure to be working with Hannah. This is a topic that's close to her heart, and we put our full heart and effort into this program as well. And what this does is all the plastics that go into the recycling bin, less than 10% of them actually get recycled. So when we go and put these products into recycled plastic that can then be brought into your home, you know that recycling has actually happened. You know that that company has made a decision to create a priority to clean up what's out there, bring it back into their supply chain, and then offer a better packaging product to their consumer. And I think those companies should be supported. And the more that we support them, companies like Child's Farm, Children's Shampoo, they use 100% prevented ocean plastic. It's just a more sustainable children's shampoo than another option. Choose them, prefer them, and then guess what? Other people will come on board.
Do you think we're seeing the end of single-use prep plastic? And do you think we'll see that in time, really, to actually prevent more challenges sort of emerging, really? I mean, obviously, aspects such as this kind of address that issue. Do you think we are getting there?
Well, it's really important to discuss the reduction of unnecessary plastic. When people talk about the eradication of plastic, it's too simplistic of an argument because some plastic is really useful. So when you do have to use plastic, use a better version of it. Recycled plastic is 1/5 the carbon footprint of new plastic. It supports coastal communities as they collect it and bring it away from at-risk areas. It's a better version of that plastic, which sometimes is actually useful.
And Hannah, you obviously continue to sort of train on a daily basis. You still work on that system. Are you seeing any slight improvement, or do you sometimes actually come away from your training and you sort of shake your head and you think, what's going on there?
Yeah, no, not yet. I think it's going to be an awfully long time until we do see an improvement. You know, I think plastic is now in our environment and I don't think we'll ever be able to completely eradicate it. And you know, like Rafi says, you know, some plastics are good and very useful, but it's, you know, I feel like we must have enough plastic in the world now. We don't need to make more. Surely we can use what we've already made. And that's exactly what Rafi and Prevented Ocean Plastic are trying to do.
It's such a strong point, if I can build on that, which is there's a stat out there that there's $100 billion of plastic laying on the ground. Like Hannah said, the plastic is there already. We just need to pick it up, support the collectors, and reuse it instead of making new plastic from oil and petrochemicals and just pushing more out there.
And just returning briefly to Hannah, I mean, you mentioned obviously Rio 2016, and every beach, marina, coastal area that you visited effectively was affected by plastic. I mean, that must be quite, I mean, for somebody who's obviously a fantastic sailor working through all sorts of things, but that must be really sort of sad to see that in terms of just the family of humanity, really.
100%. It's heartbreaking. And that's, you know, that's what pushed me into doing my own research and starting to understand this topic more, was seeing that firsthand. And so the more people that can get involved in beach cleans and litter pickups and all that kind of thing, you know, whilst it might feel like a small drop, it raises awareness, it brings people on that journey, and it educates more people to the problem. And so, you know, solutions are more likely to be found.
Rafi, where can people go to find out more details about your own company, and indeed Prevented Ocean Plastic, and how people can actually help in their own way?
So we're really interested in giving the depth of information on recycling. So on our YouTube channel, Prevented Ocean Plastic, you see into the collection centers, onto the coastlines, into the recyclers. And then, of course, there's our website, preventedoceanplastic.com.
Which, of course, is a wonderful way to pop into the future. But there we are, Prevented Ocean Plastic, a great line there. It's been awesome connecting with you, good self. Hannah, it's always a delight to actually connect with somebody who's a genuine superheroine in so many ways. Obviously, we wish you well with respect to that. We'll throw in two final questions because it's kind of like recycling in our own way. Hannah, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Absolutely.
Good. That's okay. And Rafi, has it been okay for yourself as well?
Absolutely great. Thank you very much.
Well, the next critical question is, can we look forward to connecting with you again in the near future? Will you be happy to come back and talk to us more about Prevented Ocean Plastic? And hopefully, Hannah, we'll see improvements.
100%. Yeah, always happy to come and talk about this topic. It's such an important one. Anytime.
And Alex, we have our Prevented Ocean Plastic Research Center here ready to give you stats, facts, information on how ocean plastic prevention is possible.
Rafi Shire from Prevented Ocean Plastic, and indeed Hannah Mills, MBE, gold medalist sailor, and indeed official ambassador for Prevented Ocean Plastic, effectively first ambassador. So it's very important. You know, we're working that process there. Excellent stuff. Keep on keeping on. And let's hope when next we speak that challenge, 200 blue whales, 20,000 tons of plastic. It's not good. Take care. Speak soon.
Thank you.